This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit RT11.com.
Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fun drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, today is July 23rd, 2019. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here. Again, it's heritageradionetwork.org. We have a special show. We listen to our listeners, and we appreciate those of you who have been listening for many, many years. We're on our 490th episode, and we've been doing this for 10 years. But Ethan Siegler, who's he's an MBA student out of USC, did a study. So, Ethan, introduce yourself and tell us quickly what you did and why you're interested in being on the show with us.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, as Jimmy mentioned, I'm from USC Marshall, just graduated, and I was really interested in how consumers are selecting the beers and breweries they choose in the LA area.
Great, man. Thank you. And we kind of built the whole show around it. We're talking in general about just kind of like sales data, consumer sales data. And we've got a bunch of industry experts who are kind of working in that field. So one guy I just met first time on the radio, his family's been doing this, analyzing industry data for how long?
About 50 years. It's my grandpa actually started what was the first industry trade publication for the beer business in 1970. And my dad runs the company now, and my name is David Steinman. I'm the senior editor for our craft publication, Craft Brew News. But really, we're just jack of all trades, writing about everything from sales data to the latest news and mergers and acquisitions, things like that. Policy,
bigger industry
data trends. And trends that we're following very closely and keeping in touch with as many breweries as we can and distributors in the process.
You had a couple insights into, you looked at Ethan's report. What were some few things that jumped out at you?
Well, I mean, it seemed pretty on point, but there's not that much consumer level data that, you know, is very concrete. It's a little bit wishy-washy, to be honest. There's nothing that you can really ever say is 100%, but it does feel like the consumer doesn't necessarily think the same way that industry thinks, and that was one of the themes that of Ethan's report that sort of jumped out at me, where you've got people who don't really know how to differentiate what they're looking for in terms of style when they're trying to buy a beer at a bar. And the way that we're segmenting everything out as an industry or as a bar or a retail store, it feels like they're setting it up as if they knew.
Great. And also another guest who's dealing with data often.
I think about beer a little more than I'd like to admit. But my name's Gage. I'm from beermenus.com and Non Sequitur Beer Project. And so our beer menus focus is on providing consumers with information about where they can buy the beer that they want, or, you know, tracking what's available, as well as business tools to help bars and restaurants sell more of the beer that they're carrying by organizing the information about their beers, including, you know, descriptions, styles, and just like nice print menus, online menus, TV menus, so that customers know what they're purchasing.
So do you have any consumer data, or you more have data about what's selling at retail level?
So I've got a lot of information about what customer beer drinkers are searching for, what they want to drink. Right now, you know, we're seeing a lot of the sort of either like non-alcoholic or non-beer stuff that's getting into our space. You know, hard seltzers, things like Natter Days, which I couldn't bring on the show as much as I tried really hard to get it.
They wouldn't let them bring it in.
They wouldn't, yeah. It's out there. There's a lot of that, but, you know, we see the last time I was
but
on
the
show.
The staff at Roberta's drinking it all.
The last time I was on the show, I think we had a similar conversation. And, you know, the point that I made first and foremost is that IPA is king, and it's not changing. And I bet Ted, who hasn't been introduced yet, sorry, I'm jumping the gun. But, like, the search data points to it. And if you did a breakout by style, I imagine you'd find that IPA is key. And because consumers are making decision around style. That was the one thing that we took away as the most important.
Overwhelmingly. Like, yeah. The data is showing that's the factor they're looking at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's a lot of IPA. When we look at this list of, you know, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, all across the country for what's being searched.
Right, let's get next last guest.
Okay, I'm Ted Kenny. I own Top Hops Beer Shop on the Lower East Side of New York. And yeah, IPA is definitely king. And, you know, everyone gave up on filtering any kind of beer, you know, a couple years ago. At least here on the East Coast. I mean, yeah, the cloudier, the better.
But Ted, your background is interesting. Like, you're industry veteran before you opened Top Hops.
Yeah, I've had Top Hops now for 7.5 years, and I finally eclipsed the time that I spent at InBev, at AB InBev. I was there for 5 years, and it seemed like, you know, a decade or seven. But it's
but what kind of data do you look for? Is there any data that's available to you that you regularly use? You know, now as you're a Good Beer Seal, you know, top, you know, beer bar retailer.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're looking to our customer and asking, you know, having our customer tell us what they want. It's definitely the IPA. It's definitely local. You know, and the thing about the data that's available out there is you can't really get much data on a, you know, a 2,000 barrel brewery that just opened up. You know,
yeah.
And meanwhile, that's what everybody's looking for. So it's trying to keep current on what's going on. It's all local, which when I opened up 7 years ago, it was not all local. We had a lot more people interested in a lot of things from around the country and around the world. It's very much now a local driven market. So it's a little hard to get the researchable information on that.
Okay, let's go. Keep going, guys. Gage, you kind of took the helm here.
Oh, no, I'm in charge. Welcome. This is my show now. I mean, certainly...
He's a natural.
When we... so we've spent a lot of time trying to engineer building menus for in-bar and restaurant use that makes sense and help the consumer make a purchase decision. And the information that we're going to include on a menu is description of the beer, if available, which with a 2,000-barrel brewery, it can be hard. Some of these guys don't write descriptions for their own beers.
Basil,
Finback, I'm talking to you. but then it's ABV, style, and location. And just providing that little bit of information for a consumer drives their purchase, makes they'll spend double the money that they would if they didn't have that information available.
So ABV, style, and
location. So, if it's a local beer, and that's huge. And being able to organize that information is also key.
So, Ethan.
Yeah, it's definitely speaking to that. In my research, it focused a lot in the LA area, and there it's the story of the brewery that's really making a beer stand out and stick out in people's memory. So if the beer is made by an all-women brewery or someone who supports their local community, it's more than just a, I liked the beer and forgot about what it was 2 days later. They actually remember some of the details behind it, and then when they're at the store, they see it on the shelf, they're interested, it pops out to them, and that's what's driving a lot of these repeat purchases and really long-term interest, because, you know, beautiful packaging could sell the beer the first time, you just have to have something good in the glass.
Did you get a sense for how the consumers were learning the stories of the businesses? Is it like, I'm going to the brewery and someone is telling me what we're about, or I went to the website to learn that? How are they learning?
Yeah, so there's really a couple of methods, but it all starts with the brewer themselves. The brewery needs to be forming these, I call it mindful drinking moments, where instead of just using a thumbs up, thumbs down, do they like it or not assessment, taking the time to teach someone a little bit about the beer or make them slow down and think about what's actually in their glass rather than just it's liquid and alcoholic. And so from the brewer side, there's a whole bunch of these guided tastings as opposed to just a tap takeover, or there's a beer and food pairing. And that all of these are things that make people slow down and actually think about what's in the glass. But then from a consumer standpoint, people love to learn stuff. You know, people like to do things while they drink, whether it's hang out with friends, play trivia, and, you know, they're learning from the brewery, they're learning at the bar, whether there's a well-educated bartender, or they're also learning from packaging. You know, as much as these minimalistic, beautiful designed packages can be, they also have no information. So, you know, while the art on it's gorgeous, you have no idea what's actually going to be inside the package.
A lot of times you can't even find the name of the beer.
David.
Well, that was just making me think of this one brand in particular, Firestone Walker's 805 Blonde Ale, that really, I mean, when you think about hitting on branding and local, they've got the zip code on the brand, you know, front and center, and it's big, and it's that brand has grown. Most of its sales are in California. I think 80% of its sales are in California, and it's the 11th largest craft brand sold nationally in scan data in wow. chain stores.
That's great. And Ted, so for you, as you know, a top retail beer bar place, what are things that jump out for you? You know, are you looking for products that are moving? How do you know they're moving? Obviously,
you know, always looking for products that are moving. I would say that, you know, number one is style, but right behind that is brewery. You know, and the ones, you know, I was actually doing some buying today just before I came over here. The ones that are moving are like, you know, guys that are local here but actually have a national name, so and national play.
Who are you talking about?
Well, the Twins, Evil Twin and his brother Mickler. You know, those definitely resonate with people from across the country. And since they both have a presence here in New York now, and Mickle opened the place up in City Field, those guys also have, you know, really interesting labels. And then beyond that, it's, and one of the things that I like about those two is that it's not just all IPA. I was thinking about this while we were talking here. One of the reasons why I got into craft beer and why I opened Top Ops and stock 700 plus different brands of beer is everybody was drinking lager for, you know, Pilsner lagers forever. And we're like, oh, wait, no, there's all these great other styles of beer out there.
Yeah, there was this, I don't know if you saw this, it went around the internet a couple days ago. Someone used the Wayback Machine, which we've talked about here before, to pull the top beers from like 2003. And Rogue Dead Guy, I mean, not only 2003, but that was a top beer for a long time. And now I couldn't name someone who makes a Maibach, right? Do you even have a Maibach on the shelf right now? you'd have to go and dig around.
Yes, but that's because we've talked about 50 German beers. So yeah, right. We've got a
Einbecker.
Yeah.
But those can be hard to come by now because you're just getting inundated with IPA.
Yeah. Well, I saw in your studies too, Ethan, that you said that dark beer doesn't appeal to people. It seems heavy. So do you feel like that we are skewed towards IPAs and like sours are trendy, so everyone's jumping on that? When I'm more like what Gage is saying. I want a more well-rounded beer list. You know, for everyone that's buying an IPA, there's still someone that to me that's asking for like a malty beer, like an amber lager or something.
I also gravitate towards some darker beers. In fact, last weekend I had a delicious brown ale, and it was the first brown ale I think I saw in a month or two, and I'd probably go another month or two before finding another one on the menu. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I definitely think with consumers, there might be a bit of an education gap in some areas where often, they taste something that's really dark and roasty, and it turns them off from that entire spectrum. And often you mentioned that the study shows that dark beers are perceived as heavy. Guinness is often listed as the heaviest beers consumers can think of, and that's, I don't know, what, 4%?
4.2%.
Yeah. It's 40 calories.
Yeah, it almost, on the different, you know, technical things, it's almost the same as Bud Light. It's the same calories.
I think it's less.
Yeah, it's within a tenth of a percent. I mean, yeah. It's right there.
Take the corn out, you know. It's corn fed. That makes you fat. David, jump in, because you got a whole different perspective on this. Industry analyst. What size breweries are you typically following?
Well, we're from AB and on down, but in the craft, and same goes for craft. It's all of AB's acquired breweries at this point, and Sam Adams, now Dogfish, part of the Boston Beer team. That's more of a recent change, and then on down from the largest craft brewers that are more national, and into some of these all of these local players that have popped up now, 7,500 and counting. Across the country.
But for guys like, you know, you're in an MBA program like Ethan, and you're studying this data, there's jobs in this, then, obviously.
I mean, absolutely. There's at least 2,000 breweries that are in planning currently that have TTB permits but have not opened their brewery yet. And there's been, which is incredible to think of. There's going to be 10,000 breweries in this country, most likely within the next couple of years. The Brewers Association chief economist Bart Watson said back at the Craft Brewers Conference earlier this year, and it just seems like that kind of growth at the local level absolutely will provide jobs. The only thing is it's getting tougher out there. This has become more difficult of an industry each year that we're looking at the data. It's not as easy to grow as a whole segment. So some of the larger brewers are taking the lumps right now in sales data.
Since we're talking large brewers, Ethan, you mentioned the term mobility gap. Let's just talk about getting to a certain level. What is mobility gap?
Yeah, so that's the general phenomena where it's really hard, or it's easy to get to a certain size, and it's really hard to get past that. So you see, I think we're talking about 50,000 barrels a year as kind of that sweet spot where they're still growing, but it's really hard to grow past that without taking on a ton of debt or getting acquired or doing something dramatic, whether it's a merger with another brewery.
And David, so you mentioned your father. So your family has been doing this a long time. I only recently met you. You met us after the Jeff Alwell show a few months ago.
Sure.
So tell your father spoke at the CBC conference.
That's right. Well, it just made me think. I had never heard the term mobility gap before, but that fit right in with, yeah. So at CBC on the panel was Natalie Salerzo at Russian River, and she just, and her and Vinny and Russian River just invested a whole bunch of money into an expansion out there in Northern California for a beautiful new brewery in a time when it's really difficult to be justifying those kinds of expansions. You know, a lot of there's been more and more stories of brewers falling into traps of going into debt and, you know, getting trapped by that debt, maybe having to file for bankruptcy, something like that, if the growth stops. But Natalie talked to everybody that she knew, basically. She said, interviewing them on what their happiest moment of their business was in terms of volume. What was the cap on that? And they exclusively pretty much came to about a 50,000 barrel marker before they had to really start thinking a little bit more about investing in that growth and going into debt maybe or doing a deal.
It's very interesting. So going back to like measuring, you know, local data, Gage, you guys have data on beers in different cities. Mm-hmm. First, tell us what you brought, because I know you brought a couple of beers. And what's selling? This is interesting for us. What is actually sell or people are searching for on beermenus.com?
Oh, I mean, so because we rank really well in search engines, we end up pulling in people, you know, who are looking for places like Top Hops, but also people who are this sort of uneducated consumer who sees something on social media or gets hit with an ad or whatever and wants to know where to find it. So we'll find a lot of things, you know, Heineken 0.0.
Someone's looking for a beer and then menus pops up.
Right. They simply don't know where to go. They go to Google. That's everybody's beer finder, right? If they don't know about us. So they'll run that search. We typically, you know, 99 times out of 100 are going to be the top result. So we're getting, you know, there's a lot of people searching for Heineken 0.0, which is brand new. We've got the White Claws, which are performing really well.
Don't want to hear about that. Some of this stuff is scary, man.
I mean,
the growth rate
is insane for that stuff. But what's also really interesting is that we continue to see heavy hitters like Heady Topper and Pliny the Elder sit at the top of the search and follow lists for months and years at a time. I mean, I don't think they've ever left. I think those beers, Chicago UC, Zombie Dust, there's still growth in, because the people like us who know things about craft beer, we all know like, Heady Topper can't really get it, right? It'll show up every now and then, get it when I can. Pliny the Elder's sort of the same way on the West Coast. But there's new people getting into the space all of the time who are like, well, that's the big beer. That's the one I have to have. And they're just going to Google, where can I get it? And they'll call me. Consumers will call our website and say, yeah, can I get Zombie Dust? I'm in Ohio. And I'm like, I don't know, man, maybe, probably not. People call me from North Carolina for Heady Topper. I can't help you, you know? But yeah, yes.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've had people walk into Top Hops and they're like, okay, they've got the top 50 from whatever website.
Continues to happen.
You know, and it's like, okay, this beer was brewed 5 years ago and hasn't been brewed since then.
Yep.
You're not going to want it. You know, this beer is not available, only available. Trillium.
Go to Massachusetts. Yeah. Go
go stand online. You know, you get all that. It's you know, I'm like, okay, Speedway Stout. I got that.
Right. Can you do that know? Well, we didn't talk about the beers we brought. So I brought, am I the only one who brought beer? You guys, you degenerates, huh? Nothing? All right. Well, now you're all bold into me.
Beermenus.com, man.
And he owns a bar. Come on.
Tenley has 700 different beers.
I will take this opportunity to plug my fine friends who donated beer for a Planned Parenthood charity event, actually. So I brought Industrial Arts Tools of the Trade, which is their extra pale ale. We've also got, yet to be opened, a Finback Sour IPA. That they donated because they wanted to help my brewery raise some money for charity. So that was great. And we're also all drinking a Flora wine spritzer. Is this is the Tiki, yeah?
Yep.
Yes. So Flora was started by the folks who run Graft, who are great on Iador. I love them. They're very amazing, and I hope they listen to this.
Graft Cider.
And so now they've got this wine spritzer new project, which is beautiful packaging and, you know, marketed to the same audience of people who are mindful of well-being and health in their drinks.
So what about all these new canned beverages, David?
Well, cans are absolutely what's growing most of all at retail. And actually, bottles now have gotten to the point where they're declining in the scan data that we look at.
Wow.
At least in the craft realm.
Ted, you want to pop that fin back?
Yeah, yeah. It's cans all the time. Everyone's got everything from the 12-ounce, 6-packs, 12-packs, to and even 15-packs to to the 16-ounce, 19.2s.
These other products, because I'm saying this is like a wine spritzer in a can.
Yeah, those are starting to pop up more and more for sure. And the cider companies are trying to get into it. Some of the Anheuser-Busch InBev has, you know, like a ton of new different products similar to that that they're testing out in small doses, market by market, and it just goes on down. There's local companies doing it as well. But
you know, it makes me think about that. I think sometimes I have the conversation. We're in the craft beer niche, and I feel that there's a huge beverage market that's bigger than all beer. Like beer, there's always going to be beer sales, and there's always going to be drink sales. But I feel that the real growth in everything is just this larger beverage category.
Most of the, you know, fastest growing micro trends in beer right now are, or the broader definition of beer, are from non-alc beverages right now. Mm-hmm. Seltzer is a fast growing thing that's happening in non-alc world, and now, you know, they've dipped over into the fastest growing category in quote unquote beer world. And it just, you got hard kombuchas have started to show up more and more. There's more and more looking outside of the box.
There's certainly a lot of people looking to wellness. Their alcohol consumption to be better for them, ignoring that it's poison or whatever. but I think I talk about this a lot at work. I think this is probably something, this is sort of what you're getting to, is that we think about craft beer as a certain level of consumer who knows more or less what they want, right? Who cares about IPA, who cares about local, but there is a bigger category of this casual drinker who doesn't really, and maybe never will cross that line. I mean, we hope they do, right? That's better for us than stick in hard seltzer. But one of the data points that I found really interesting was that the consumer is more likely to pick something new, to try something they haven't had, if it's at a brewery or at a bar, than at a grocery store, which speaks to the fact that they're uneducated to some degree. They don't know as much as they could, so they're going to stick with something that they know rather than being somewhere where they can learn and then try new things and probably typically grow. I mean, we've experienced growth, therefore those folks are growing into beer drinkers or have over time, you know?
And Ethan, I know you studied that particularly.
Yeah, so there's a real simple reason that I found in my qualitative research for why folks explore at a bar or a brewery, which is almost all of them will give you a sample. So if you want to try it, you try it. If you don't like it, it's zero risk. And even though folks are less likely to explore at a liquor store, bottle shop, supermarket, whatever it is, there's still, I don't have the exact number, I could pull it up, but I think it's like 70% of consumers will try something new at a store. So, you know, even there, they're still willing to try new stuff.
That's great. Guys, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Root 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Root 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Root 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, we're talking about data, sales data, beer consumer data. Ethan, what is your study, man? Ethan Siegler, from a recent MBA grad, did a nice study about beer data.
Yeah, so it was looking at the whole consumer journey, whether it's from thinking about, geez, maybe I need something in the fridge to drink, to actually buying it and putting in your glass and having it with friends, and definitely looking from a small brewer perspective, how can you use that journey to make sure you get sales? How can you build your presence? And how can you make sure you make people happy? That's why everyone brews in the first place, is to make a great beer that people will enjoy.
So Ted, what were you talking about?
We
took an ad and these guys talked about interesting stuff.
Before the break, we were talking about education, and that's the reason why people go to breweries and go to beer bars and stuff, is to be educated, usually in a.
So I might go to a grocery store and I know I'm going to get a certain brand. I want an IPA. My friend wants a lager.
Right, and they're looking for education. They may not even think about it as education because they're looking at more of a casual interaction with somebody. At Top Hops, we strive to do that every day, and you know, one of the great things is listening to conversations going on between two of our customers that have never met each other before, talking about the different aspects of the beer and which beer they're trying, where were they recently. But in addition to that, we offer classes. We have structured classes that we do, but it's a great way to introduce people.
What are a couple of the classes, Ted?
Well, we have history of beer, beer 101 for new people that are just exploring craft beer, and then as a follow up to that, we have so now you're a beer nerd.
Sorry,
do you get a certification for that?
A pin. Now I'm gonna have to go.
Good question.
But you know, we get a lot of people to come in and they want to learn more about beer, and you know, and you know, part of Ethan's at the beginning of Ethan's paper, he says that a lot of the people don't want to admit that they're novice, that they're you know, yeah, new to craft beer or new to beer, and you know, this is an opportunity. You know, these types of interactions with brewers, and you know, we were saying earlier that that people really want to identify with the brewer and the brewery. And, you know, part of that is the education of getting to know, you know, and people want to support, you know, businesses that they have a, you know, a common connection with. You really find that with the, that is definitely a constant from, you know, before I got, you know, I knew it before I got into the business. I knew that was one of the big things that drove me to want to be in craft beer. And, you know, wanted to share that with a lot of other people.
And what's great about beer is it's just such a humble, approachable thing. You know, not to say that wine and spirits aren't humble and approachable, but there's this sense of, let's just have a beer. Don't really have to think about it too hard. Have something that's just nice and comforting. And at the same time, there's all these amazing breweries making spectacular products that can be paired with Michelin star, five-star restaurants, and can be put against the best food in the world because it's just such high quality product, and it's both approachable but also this high quality, you know, luxury product.
Let me ask, just that there are a couple of things in your study, Ethan, I just wanted to you said style knowledge is limited, so you're assuming in the larger market not everyone's like a super beer geek, and it says if a session IPA isn't available, the customers may not select a pale ale but they'll go to a different style they like.
Yeah, so customers kind of have in their head the styles they like, whether it's they know they like stouts or they know they like IPAs or pale ales or whatever it is. And if they're not able to find that exact wording of it, they don't always have the knowledge to say, oh, this is equivalent or this is quite similar. So what I always find entertaining is how a pale, someone said, let's make a really hoppy, boozy pale ale. We'll call it an IPA. And then people decided that it's a bit too boozy, a bit too hoppy, so they'll scale it back a little bit and call it a session IPA. And if folks aren't able to find that session IPA, they might not know to start looking for a pale ale as something maybe comparable. They might go, you know, to a red or to a, you know, a Belgian style that's just completely different.
And it's funny that you mentioned that, because breweries are fracturing existing styles into new styles or trying to, you know, invent something new. You know, for a minute we had the Brut IPA, and there was very little
agreement. Is that gone already, Ted?
It's pretty much gone, right?
They still have them on the West Coast.
Yeah, well, you know, that's where they got made, and I think that people listened to Kim Sturdivant when he was like, this is a new thing and we're going to make it this way. But truth be told, it's basically just a dry hop.
Who is that guy?
He's the head brewer at a social beer company, social beer something or other, in San Francisco. And he had a particular way of making it, but then when it left San Francisco, people put their own spin on a style that wasn't codified, so we sort of defeated the purpose of introducing something new. And now, in the West Coast, I don't know if it's local to San Francisco specifically, there's the New Zealand-style Pilsner. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, which is incredible to me because it is just a New Zealand dry-hopped Pilsner, which is a Pilsner. An American Pilsner, if you will, which is how we've been making them, or an Italian Pilsner that's a new thing, and that's just a German-style Pilsner with noble dry hopping, which is just a hair different than the way that the historical style was identified. So now, I mean, luckily some of them have the terms that allow the consumer to go, okay, so I like a Pilsner, maybe I'll like an NZ-style Pilsner. But if we don't, we're introducing these pastry sours, these, you know, candy beers that a lot of breweries are doing. Can the consumer make that jump? Do they understand that? Or are we just making it harder, especially when you consider the reverse? If you really get into this weird sub-style, like a brut IPA or a pastry sour, and then you don't know where to go after that, and that's a flash in the pan, are you, like, stuck in this weird place where you just don't, like, you run out of beer you like because you were uneducated, and then you feel like an idiot? What I imagine is going to happen.
I mean, there's this constant debate within industry of the paradox of choice, right? There, when you have too much, it's harder to actually make your decision for what you want or what you're going to purchase. And I think that craft brewers, the craft industry a little bit, has fallen into the trap of what's new, what's next. And yeah, they're...
Yeah.
It's constant. It is what the consumer is looking for. At the same time, they're seeking new. But I think there's some signs, at least early signs, that it's starting to finally pare back a little bit. For instance, there was a survey conducted by Nielsen and the Brewers Association jointly just presented a couple days or last week that said.
What's your favorite TV show?
Yeah, what's your favorite TV show? It was The Office. No. Basically that consumers are narrowing their window of brands that they choose in a given month. And this is new. That hadn't been I don't necessarily see it in my own purchase habits. Maybe in my own purchase habits, but I don't necessarily see it everywhere else. But that's at least what their survey said. And that's the first time we've seen that number actually contract since they've been doing the survey.
I'm waiting for the double dry hop Pilsner IPA.
which is actually going to be
a wheat beer.
It depends on the brand.
I'll just give every adjective to the style that I can, and you will get none of the things you expect once you open it.
But Gage, you talk about this at your work all the time, right? Mm-hmm. These are the things. What does it matter? Don't you just have a setup where people just search for things? I mean, why do you have to know things?
Why do you have to know things? Man, if I knew the answer to that, I think I would have the answer. That's the, like, why are we alive? Because the paradox of choice is a very real thing, right? You walk into a bar, I mean, while Roberta's, where we are, love you, Roberta's, only has, what, 8 beers on tap. You can go about a 5-minute walk to the Well, where they've got 60 beers on tap. How do you even begin to approach a decision if you don't know anything? And then it's overwhelming, and of course then you fall back on the beer you've had before, or the brewery you've had before, or at least the style that you know you like.
That's how Budweiser became king of beer.
You knew the name.
That was it.
But yeah. there are some places that have over 100 beers on tap that they're organizing it in a way that the consumer enjoys and understands. And I think it gets back to what we were talking at the beginning about how we might be using the wrong words to talk about the beer. Rather than, say, a New Zealand Pilsner, which, I mean, sure, I know it's a Pilsner, but...
Sounds sexy.
Yeah, it's great. But, you know, describe it as, okay, these are hop-forward beers, or these are more bitter beers. These are going to be fruitier beers. These are going to be maltier or sweeter, or these words, you know, chocolatey, roasty, things that people can relate to their taste buds. And that's how you organize that 100 beer list.
We still have the problem in a lot of places, frustratingly, where people, they believe that IPA means necessarily bitter. There are lots of the country doesn't understand that IPA has a lot of hops, and there are multiple ways that you can implement that I see the microphone moving.
Well, I was going to say, and now hazy IPA has been, you know, the buzz, the buzz style, sub style of IPA. And that, I think, is sort of starting to teach a broader, maybe, I don't know, broader, but it's teaching more people that IPA is not necessarily bitter. Yeah. They're only bitter.
Ted, how do you do it with 700 different beers? How do you sort? How do you educate people besides your classes?
Right. Well, the
when I walk into yours, so Ethan in his report, what I liked, he said that people, they like to unplug sometimes and not be, they're sitting in their office looking at a computer. They actually want to go into a store. Like I like to go to wine stores and browse the aisles and look at, and I think this is it's what you had said. So at Top Ops, it's like that. I can walk in, there's all these coolers, I can look at the different beers.
Yeah, and when we opened up, when we were setting it up, we that was one of the things we had to grapple with, is how we're going to set it up. And, you know, there's a few different ways you can break it down, and a lot of people told me at the beginning, oh, you should really break it down by style. And we decided, or alphabetically, and I was just like, that just seems to be a lot of shuffling things back and forth a lot. So we decided to go geographically, and that seemed to be... And then under geographically, we keep everything from the same brewery together. That way, that's what, you know, people shop by, where is it from, and who's brewing it after style. But, you know, we and I'm really glad we did that, because now it would be, you know, we have 16 refrigerators, it would be 14 IPA refrigerators and two of everything else. So the, you know, but, you know, geographically, and that is starting to get a little difficult too, because you've got breweries that open in multiple locations, and okay, where's it brewed? So we decided, no, it's where the beer was. It was where the brewery originally was from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and for you guys, so we've got LA, beer menus, city versus city. What are some differences? So we've got New York. You track other major cities too, like Chicago.
Sure.
What's are there differences in what's being searched for in those other cities compared to New York?
You know, I think generally speaking, the searching for IPA, as well as, you know, what's popular on social media and in advertisements, is pretty key. But outside of this is, I don't mean for this to get political, but outside of the coast, in Middle America, not Chicago, not the biggest cities, there is a lot more want for diversity, lagers, more classical beers, a diversity of styles. That stuff still has play in places that are not the big cities and the coasts. That said,
you're saying that not in the big cities, that there's people have more wide range of interests.
Yeah, because I mean, you could easily say that it's because those beer markets are not as developed as New York, Boston, L.A., San Francisco. I had another point and I've lost it.
Well, it's that the people from outside of the major metropolitan areas are interested in a wider range of things, and the people that are in the very high density populated areas.
But it's almost like, consider where we were when you opened, right?
Yeah.
We there was variety made sense, and there was a period in the middle before we just said IPA is it, where people drank around and tried different things. And I would say that those, you know, not the major cities, smaller cities in the middle of America are where we were. But that's not to say that there aren't breweries out there who are trying to play the hits too and make cool IPAs, because, you know, they go to CBC and they see what's happening and they are on social media. So they're trying, but it's, you know, you can get people to wait in line for IPA in Massachusetts. You can't really get people to wait in line for IPA in Nebraska.
I don't wait in line. Ethan, back to your study. You were mentioning that some things play in L.A. that they wouldn't translate to New York City. What is that, a localness?
Yeah, I was really curious to know in your data if you're seeing places. So I was lucky enough to grow up in South Florida, where our version of winter was just really nice weather, maybe 70 degrees. And
rub it in.
I went to school in Rochester, so I paid my my dues.
That's right.
But I'm just curious to know, you know, in some of those areas, you would imagine that summer beers, or what we would think of summer beers in places that have winter, are going to be popular all year round. And there might be some of these bigger warming styles that aren't so popular, you know, throughout the year. So I'm curious to see what you see there.
You know, it's funny. I think that over the last couple of years, I have certainly seen, Ted, this is also, I'd like you to back me up on this, seen a shift away from explicitly referring to beers by their seasonality. Not only are fewer breweries doing seasonals in the way that we used to, but also...
crappy seasonal.
But I don't see a whole lot of summer beers anymore. I mean, I think Five Bros did one for their first summer, not... they. I don't know if they brought it back, actually. But like Brooklyn has their summer ale, and I don't think of a whole lot of other breweries who are making a summer ale, especially not, you know, small to mid-sized breweries. The same for winter, although you start making stouts and stuff, and that is a winter beer, it just doesn't get the identification. But I mean, that's just making lighter beers, more pilsners, more wheat beers, more lower alcohol beers, easy drinking. And as we shift towards cans, of course, more beers are beach beers, more beers are walking around beers. In places where that's legal.
Yeah, well, one of the thoughts behind that, seasonal, the catch-all seasonal brands are declining in all of the data that we look at, but seasonal has been replaced by just, you know, vast amount of selection. Yeah, you have everything, you have every style that you could possibly imagine available at pretty much any given time.
David, just from
thousands and thousands of breweries.
Numbers that you're talking about, because you're tracking the whole industry.
So seasonal.
So how do you see a shift? How many millions of items have changed?
I mean, okay, that's a good question. I'd have to think about how many items have, you know, are tracked and have changed over. And also, some of the data I'm thinking of right now is retail, which definitely doesn't capture the 2,000-barrel brewery that's selling everything out of its own backyard. Mm. But that being said, there's more and more brands and SKUs available at the retail level, even that is tracked, and the thought is that, you know, you've got so many thousands of brands or SKUs, you don't need necessarily a catch-all seasonal. And on top of that, the biggest seasonals like a Sam Summer and stuff like that have for many years been in decline because of that.
And then David, who actually, it's a subscription base, people pay for this data.
Yeah.
Who's getting your data, and what does it make them
thankfully
do?
Yeah. it's really from, it started out in the earliest point from all of the distributors were some of our earliest customers across the country. And then from there it sort of built. And at this point, it's the largest brewers from Anheuser-Busch, InBev on down to some of the larger craft brewers. And whoever has, you know, the more and more people that are willing to come on and check out our stuff, we welcome them. But it really, it probably does sort of, it doesn't get too low on the craft volume level. We are, you know, information is expensive.
We don't
sometimes.
Have somebody entering the data.
Exactly.
Nobody knows.
We've got the data, but we've got to price it out accordingly. But, you know, that being said, we're also always open to talking and sharing with anybody.
One thing I like about the show is that just seeing how big this industry is, and it does take me back again, the beverage sector is huge and enormous, and we like being in it. But Ted, you're on the ground, they're on the ground floor, so do you need to know all this information? Are you the one that we should be asking what sells?
We don't know, you know, we don't know what's going to sell until after it sells. But more importantly, we don't know what's not going to sell until after it doesn't sell. And you remember those days. I would say that my theory on what killed the seasonal beer was pumpkin. There was that. Everybody
and
was
dead, and we're happy about it.
They would start selling. They would the reps would start showing up selling pumpkin beer in July.
Yep.
And ugh. You know, I was like, "Are you gonna I'm like, get out of my place. Do not come back."
And does pumpkin have to mean pumpkin pie spice?
Right. And you know what? So everybody made a pumpkin beer that about 4 years ago. And you know, then there was the big pumpkin mountain that was still there for Christmas, and that was, you know, like there's always been the challenge behind naming a beer a Christmas beer or an Oktoberfest, because you know everyone loves that December fest and that January fest.
Many years ago, I don't want to say the name of the brewery, but my first introduction was probably 15 years ago. A brewery, there was an apricot wheat that was being sold at 50% discount, and it made me it killed my image of that brewery forever, and I could never get over it.
Yeah.
So I guess don't discount your beers that don't sell, right? Dump them on the market.
Give it up.
They say the two ways to kill your beer is raise your price or lower your price.
Yeah. It's funny with pumpkin beers, it almost feels like the prerequisite to the sort of pastry, sweet everything, the hazy IPA, is that we wanted, there was a large desire for beer that didn't taste like we classically understood beer to taste like, and that was much more palatable to a wider audience. That's irrelevant of age or gender, but more about just the fact that, like, you want something that's easier to drink, and a lot of beer is an acquired taste. I mean, I don't love a classic West Coast double IPA anymore. It's hard to drink. And some, like, New England triple IPAs still carry a fair amount of bitterness, and that's not pleasant anymore. We taught ourselves to be there. All of us did for many, many years. But that, as we've generally shifted away from it in the market, you see fewer of them. Now, I can't drink them. I know a lot of people who can't drink. Like, a Pliny the Elder does not drink like it used to. Not that it's not great, but it's a little tough.
No, it's a good point. Ethan, we're going to wrap up soon, but are there any other points from your study that we did not cover that this group might want to address?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for the small craft beer owner out there is that, you know, all of this data is certainly great to have, especially at a professional basis, but really it just comes down to knowing who your customers are. And that could be as simple as being at your brewery, chatting with your customers and having an interaction. And it could be as formal as actually doing surveys and sitting down with your top customers and folks you hope to be your top customers. So, you know, it doesn't have to be that intimidating. This is all just another way of getting to know who the people are that are buying from you.
And who do you call when you need to know what beer to get? So you're going to you have a special occasion event where you want to bring, you broke this down really well. So tell me more about it.
Yeah, there's all these different occasions, and I don't want to sound like I know everything, but...
But you do, so come on.
Well, so I'm the person people call when they need to get some beer advice, but I'm part of the Michler Running Club out in L.A., and if I thought I knew stuff about beer, there's folks there who've been doing this way longer than I have.
Okay, so I'm in L.A., we just went on a run. What where are you guys going to end up, and what should I be drinking?
So we're at Michler, and I'm not sure if it's allowed or not, so maybe cut this later. But people
this
bring
is live.
People bring from their own cellars and personal stock. They bring beers, but yeah, I mean, there's some great bottle shops in LA that have well curated selections. They have people who are going to guide you
so
through
it. So just tell me one that you like.
Yeah, Buzz Bottle Shop in L.A. is pretty fantastic.
And what part of L.A.?
That's downtown.
Downtown L.A. What would you get? What's a L.A. beer that
favorite.
I should get?
Oh, I love Belgian. I'm so bad at favorites. Let's see. Favorite. So I really like stuff out of Dry River. They're all their beer touches oak, so they're all naturally sour, and they're great. I think their youngest beer is usually 3-4 months old. So these are complex and sour, not just a cheap kettle sour.
And David, any data on LA or California?
LA, I just think of some of the largest brands, but I mentioned Firestone 805 before. That is literally one of the largest beer brands, period, sold in Los Angeles. At this point, that's Firestone Walker again. But we've seen some of the newer breweries pop up, like Three Weavers is one that comes to mind that has gotten a little bigger, joined the Canarchy platform with Oscar Blues, Cigar City, companies like that. LA is definitely coming along. Everywhere is coming along, local beer.
Ted, do you get any LA beers? Any interest in LA beers? Here in New York,
I mean the only LA beer I can think of that we get in is from the AB world, Golden Road. Sure. Yeah,
we do get Three Weavers at this point, right? Or at least there was for a little bit.
It's an all women owned brewery too, so if you find it, definitely support
definitely
them.
Definitely drink it. Yeah, I Other Half does bring around some of the cool kids of LA for the events. We had a little bit of Green Cheek, some Highland Park, some Monkish, the last couple weeks after Green City.
And
well.
I just asked Gage if he had any data on LA, but I don't know if he has signal here.
Yeah, it's looking like I'm not going
to
have any.
But it's something to think about, you know, the differences, and that's something you did bring up, Ethan. The difference between like you have things in LA you might know. There's certain neighborhoods, certain towns.
Yeah.
You might know it, but people in New York don't care.
And what's so tough about that is, I mean, I know the difference between Santa Monica and Venice, and they're, you know, about a mile or two away, and no one has any clue. It's all just L.A. when you
see. Oh,
but
do you know the difference between Bushwick and Williamsburg? Come
exactly.
on.
One has Hasidic Jews. I think it's...
Well, yeah, true. This has been a great show, guys. Another one we could do for hours and hours, and we're going to wrap it up. So if everyone can just once again say their name and where they work...
Ted we'll Kennedy at Top Hops at Orchard Street in Lower East Side.
Good Beer Seal Bar, man. Great work, Ted.
Thank you.
David Steinman, Beer Marketers Insights.
Thanks for having you on, man. With how many? Three generations now?
Yeah, that's it.
Industry information.
Three generations and maybe counting. Who knows?
Ethan Siegler just graduated from USC Marshall School of Business.
Thanks for doing the study.
Congratulations. My name's Gage. I'm from beermenus.com and Non Sequitur Beer Project.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining us. Big shout out to our producer, Justin Kennedy. Engineer, Matt Patterson. Congrats. He just got married. He's back. Assistant producer, Aaliyah Papes. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo. Woo.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.